From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
I'm Robert Siegel, and if you've held off on a trip or shared a ride to work or swapped the Escalade for a Prius, then you are part of a major trend. Today, the Energy Department reported the steepest drop in oil consumption in more than a quarter century. The slowdown in U.S. demand is one of the major factors pulling crude oil prices down from their highs of a month ago, as NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Crude oil prices closed today just above $113 a barrel. That's down more than 20% from their peak in early July. And, on average, nationwide, gasoline prices have dropped below $4 a gallon. The price at the pump is still too high for taxi driver David Koshaw, though. Koshaw was parked outside the San Diego airport this morning, waiting for a fare.
Well, I drive a 10 to 12 hour shift and usually spend about $45 to $50 on gas.
While gasoline prices have been coming down in recent weeks, Koshaw complains he's not as busy as he used to be.
Sometimes it's slow when the conventions are not here, and the gas prices, it's really difficult for taxi drivers.
And there's the rub, because the drop in oil and gasoline prices is largely the result of a slowing economy. As consumers and businesses hit the brakes in the first half of the year, oil consumption in the U.S. fell by 800,000 barrels a day, the biggest decrease since 1982. Back then, Americans were responding to the price shocks of the Iranian Revolution and the Iran-Iraq War. Tankred Litterdale of the Energy Department says we're seeing similar cutbacks in fuel consumption now.
It's certainly a response to higher prices, whether it's taking fewer trips to the market or purchasing a car instead of an SUV.
High energy prices are forcing consumers and businesses to reconsider both short and long-term decisions, from where to go on vacation to where and how to organize production lines. Some of those changes will be long-lasting, but behavioral changes are more fleeting. Energy analyst Mike Fitzpatrick of MF Global says there are already signs that drivers are backsliding on the conservation moves they made earlier this year.
$4, you start to see demand increase again. Consumers are going back to their old behaviors. I mean, let's face it, we live in a car culture.
Fitzpatrick says that makes it unlikely that oil prices will fall back to the levels of a year ago. In fact, he thinks prices may rebound to about $120 a barrel, especially when the weather turns colder and demand for heating oil picks up.
I mean, right now, people can change their behaviors. It's nice weather outside. They can walk to the store. They can ride their bicycles. But I think as winter sets in, it's going to be much more difficult for people to do that.
The latest forecast from the Energy Department says global demand for oil will grow about twice as fast in the last half of this year as it did during the first half. With oil supplies still relatively tight, crude oil prices may not fall much further. Scott Horsley, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. For the first time in more than 20 years, the best-selling vehicle in America is not the full-size Ford pickup. Thanks largely to high gas prices, truck sales are sinking at Chevrolet, too, like a rock.
My walk had purpose. My steps were quick and light. And I held firm to what I felt was right. Like a rock.
Bob Seger's vision of strength sold trucks for Chevy, and maybe for everyone else, too. Ford has been building trucks tough for decades now. Dodge has its Ram. Toyota got in on the action, making its giant Tundra in Texas. But as strong as the truck market has been these many years, it's not invincible. NPR's Noah Adams went to West Virginia, thinking it was time to talk trucks.
I've had a couple pickup trucks in the past, and I think about them a lot, so I know most people have a truck story to tell. I went to the small town of Harper's Ferry. It figures in Civil War history, so there's a lot of tourists coming through. Patty Seclemian of Virginia was quick to use the word lust in the same sentence with pickup. She doesn't have a truck, but her dad back in Utah always did. The final one was a GMC.
After my father passed away, my mom kept the pickup truck in the carport because it was an open carport, and she thought that she was safer if she had two cars there. People would think that she wasn't alone. But my brother had such pickup lust, one day he came and took it from her. And he lived in Florida, so he took it a long ways from her.
My name is Jason Wright.
Wright is a volunteer firefighter. He believes that he needs to carry three self-contained breathing devices in the back of his Chevy pickup. He knows every bolt on this truck. His answers are technical.
In my truck, I'm running 35-inch tires that are 12 inches wide, so I have 4 feet of rubber on the ground. Right now, I'm running a V6 Chevy 262, and I'm getting 22 miles a gallon.
I met a guy trimming grass, sweating, no shirt, bandana. John Garza says he's long had a fondness for Toyota pickups, owned a couple of 87s.
The current one is an 89 Toyota 4x4.
Garza prefers the old and smaller trucks. He's also a mechanic. He likes to get deep inside the engines because he wants to see the good numbers on the odometer. The 89...
163,000. I'm currently working on... I do all my own work on it. It's got a blown head gasket right now. That's one of the problems with a 22R motor, but it's easy to work on.
So John Garza, he's Toyota, but Gary Mathis, a carpenter working nearby, out of the back of his Ford F-150, says, no, that's wrong. Ford is what you stick with. His loyalty is almost a country song lyric.
My dad had a Ford, and I have Fords, so that's the way it is. Brothers.
But a sky blue motorcycle is today's ride for Ken Kelly, passing through town. He has a towing business back in Pennsylvania. Lots of trucks. He's also strong for Fords.
The one I drive is a 98, but I also have a 1940 Ford pickup.
Do you?
Yes, I do.
Tell me about the 40.
Well, it came from North Dakota. It was a farm truck out there for many, many years, and I brought it home, and I'm in the process of restoring it. Very little rust on it.
What's the radio like?
There is none in it.
No radio.
It had one windshield wiper.
You mean it was made with one windshield?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
No kidding.
They didn't come out with two wipers till 46.
Ken Kelly has trucks for his work and the truck for his hobby. But this year, people are making choices. There's a Subaru Forester parked here at the visitor center. Guy said he used to have a Ford Ranger, likes the Subaru better. But no trade-in story could beat the one told by a very lean and tan young man who glides up also to get a map. His name is Steve Eggers. This summer, he sold his truck to buy the bicycle he's riding.
Gas was going up, and the pickup truck just kind of seemed a little obsolete, so I figured I'd trade it in and buy a really nice bike.
Eggers has a handmade Rocky Mountain Sherpa touring bike with everything he needs on a rack. And he is riding from Asheville, North Carolina to New York City and then back to South Carolina for college. Figure a cost per mile, practically zero.
And plus, when you're on this thing, you can see the countryside. You see everything at a lot slower pace, so you really take it all in. Really appreciate the miles.
I'm thinking about finding a pizza place for supper, but I'll need some gas before I head back to Washington. At the car rental office in the morning, they put me in a Toyota Tundra. I'd wanted a pickup for the story, but not especially a huge slate gray crew cab made in Texas SR5 engine with a gas tank that holds 26 gallons. I bet they were happy to finally rent somebody a truck. With this thing, you get scared at the gas station. Okay, what I've been doing, I just can't stand to see the total price I've been putting $20 in at a time. Kind of slurps it up. The Toyota Tundra, they'll teach this one in business school. Finally, you build a truck to line up with the Fords, the Dodges, and the Chevys, put your plant in Texas, spend millions of dollars slamming it around on Super Bowl television, and then comes spring and the price of gasoline shuts down the market and eventually shuts down the San Antonio Tundra plant. But look at this coming at me down the street, a big, white, new-looking Tundra, and I see a temporary tag. I pursue the gentleman, Keith Marks, local business guy, traded an SUV for the Tundra.
I've had some SUVs because I always want to have something to keep my bicycle in. But with the extended cab, I can keep the bike in the back if the weather's bad. And also, I think the SUVs, the value of them are significantly dropping quicker than the trucks because at least the back of the truck's versatile. Mm-hmm. Where in many cases, the SUV is just an open, empty cavern.
You must have got a great deal.
I did. Got about $9,500 off MSRP.
Keith Marks says, and says it in a positive way, that he's getting 16 miles to the gallon in his new Tundra. A truck, of course, is a working vehicle. Sometimes big is good, but 2008 with $4 gas is already the year that separates truck needs from truck wants. Noah Adams, NPR News. I see myself again.
Whoever is elected will have more than bad guys to worry about. He'll have a massive national debt, an annual budget deficit of nearly $500 billion. For the candidates, that is just one issue of many. But for David Walker, it's the issue. David Walker is the former Comptroller General of the United States. He's basically the country's auditor in chief. And now he's running the Peterson Foundation and crusading to make fiscal responsibility a priority in the presidential race. David Walker and I talked about where the candidates stand on this. But first, for the record,
I have not endorsed either candidate. I'm staying neutral on the presidential race. I have spoken with leading economic policy advisors for both candidates, and I expect to stay in touch with both campaigns.
Okay, I do know that the founder of your organization, Peter Peterson, he has endorsed John McCain.
Pete Peterson endorsed John McCain about 2 years ago before he even knew he was going to have the money to set up a foundation. That's his personal views. It's totally separate and distinct from the foundation, which is staunchly nonpartisan and non-ideological.
Okay, let's go through some numbers here. How much is the United States in the hole?
The United States is in the hole $53 trillion as of last September.
What do you mean by $53 trillion? I thought the national debt right now was somewhere upwards of $9 trillion.
We've got about $11 trillion in liabilities, including debt held by the public, as well as a number of other liabilities. We have a $7 trillion unfunded obligation for Social Security, a $34 trillion unfunded obligation for Medicare, of which about $8 trillion relates to the new prescription drug benefit, which was supposed to save money, according to some, and $1 trillion in miscellaneous. The total of all of that is $53 trillion. And how much money does the United States have to fund this? Zip.
Now, both candidates, John McCain and Barack Obama, have laid out some of their budget proposals on their websites. They're not terribly specific. McCain says he will have a balanced budget by 2013, largely by cutting spending. What do you think of that?
Well, it's one thing to have a balanced budget by 2013. It's one thing to say you're going to do it by cutting spending, but you need to get into specifics. I think what's more important is we're way beyond balancing the budget. We're in a $53 trillion hole that gets deeper, $2 to $3 trillion a year, even with a balanced budget. So those that say they merely want to balance the budget, it's not enough.
Well, how does someone like you hear it when McCain says no new taxes?
I think most of the gap is going to have to be made up through restructuring Medicare, health care, and Social Security, as well as constraining spending. But in my personal view, we're going to need more revenues as well.
Let's turn to Obama now. He says he'll reinstate pay-as-you-go rules in budgeting in the Congress. He also says he'll stop the Iraq war and use that money to pay down deficits anyway. What do you think of that?
Well, I think there are a lot of misconceptions out in America right now. You could eliminate all earmarks, you could eliminate all of the Bush tax cuts, and you could pull out of Iraq in January of 2009, and that only solves about 15% of our $53 trillion problem. We're going to need to do a lot more dramatic things than that.
Which plan's better, Obama's or McCain's?
I don't think either one of them have a plan yet that comes close to putting us on a more prudent fiscal path. In the case of Senator Obama, he's talking about a lot of additional spending. In the case of Senator McCain, he's talking about additional tax cuts. Neither one of them plans add up right now, but it's still fairly early, and I'm hoping that fiscal responsibility and intergenerational equity will become a major issue in the general election campaign.
David Walker is president and CEO of the Peter G. Peterson Foundation, a nonpartisan think tank based in New York. Thanks very much, Mr. Walker.
Happy to be with you. Take care.
The Peter Peterson Foundation helped fund a new documentary film about the nation's debt. It's called IOUSA, and it hits theaters later this month. Think of all the electricity generated in the United States as a pie. Then carve out a nice big slice, a fifth of the pie. That's the Department of Energy's goal for wind power. It could take decades. It's the goal. Well, there's a tiny town in the northwest tip of Missouri where the wind power slice is the whole pie, and then some. Frank Morris of member station KCUR in Kansas City reports.
Tag along with Helen Jo Stevens on her morning walk, and it's best not to get between her dog Quincy and a number of certain posts along the way.
Whoa. He's got them all marked, Frank.
Stevens is about 5 feet tall with curly gray hair and a quick smile. She's wearing running shoes. She's the mayor here. And for decades, Rockport's decline has been almost as predictable as her morning walk. The population's fallen off almost 2% a year lately. But trudge up to the old cemetery, and it's Rockport's future that comes into view.
Okay, here's one of the turbines you see right in front of you here. To our right. Well, I've never talked this much walking those hills.
But Stevens has been talking a lot lately. Reporters from around the world are calling because the wind turbines in Rockport generate more electricity than the people here use.
To become the one and only and first wind-powered community in the whole United States, it's overwhelming, actually. How did this ever happen to a little old town like ours?
Mostly, it had to do with a guy named Eric Chamberlain.
There are cattle behind this gate. They have every right to graze around that wind turbine, and we just don't want them getting out and trying to herd them back in.
The four slowly spinning white turbines up on this ridge are as tall as 35-story buildings.
Did I ever think this would happen? No, not in a million years.
Really?
No. This is beyond my imagination.
Chamberlain's inspiration came years ago, when his old mortuary job took him up to a funeral in northern Iowa. It was a cold, lonely drive past a lot of wind turbines.
I'm thinking, why can't we do this? You know, we've got wind.
So there he was, his mind spinning, driving along with a corpse in back of the hearse.
That's obviously why I didn't pull over on the way up. You know, I had to on the way back.
He got out and looked. He got online and searched. The more he learned, the more this wind power deal made sense. At least to him.
Well, I would say I was persistent.
Well, he came to my office and talked to me about it and wanted to know what my opinion was. And I told him, Eric, you offer your rocker.
Raymond Hennigan runs the phone, cable, and data storage company in Rockport. Back then, there was no precedent for this kind of project and nobody to pay for it. But when a wind power developer showed up one day, Chamberlain was ready with wind data collected from the hills. Then John Deere, the tractor company, brought in turbines and leased the land to put them on. It put 24 up nearby and another 4 inside the city limits, wired those 4 to the city-owned power grid, and bang, the 1,300 residents of Rockport, Missouri, had more wind energy than they could use. Almost everyone here, Hennigan included, is delighted.
We all know that energy cost is going to go nothing but up. And if we can stabilize some of these costs, we can provide decent jobs for the future for these young people.
24 of them work here, in a plain building just off Main Street. Tall banks of computers here back up data from companies across the country. Michael Goins runs this fast-growing part of the business, and he's proud to be running it, mainly on wind power.
And what we're wanting to do is to produce a logo and enable our customers to display that logo that says, hey, I'm carbon neutral, or my website currently is being powered by wind power right now.
Of course, the wind doesn't always blow. And when it's still, Rockport buys power off the grid. Most days, though, wind power runs everything here, and Rockport exports electricity. Folks here hope that system will help the town stop exporting population. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris.